You've also been influential in this development of the school.
As a matter of fact, I was coming back from Fairbanks one time, and I believe it was summer of 1983, and I saw all these vehicles at the school. I hadn't thought that much about the school. But I looked over there, and something's going on. So being the inquisitive type, I poked my nose in where it didn't belong and found out that they were putting in the playground equipment. And so I volunteered to help and showed up the next day, and there is Dick Simmons and Marion, no one else particularly. And I was the only one who showed up to help. Apparently the other meeting was to discuss showing up to help. And that affected a lot of people, a lot more people than showed up to help. So, anyway, I'm not exactly sure what went on with all of this, but the upshot of it was that they decided to pay me to put in this playground equipment. And the next day, Bob Jones showed up with Sean, who was, I think, about 11 or 12 at the time. And we got to work and we put in the playground equipment, and it's still sitting there today, and there hasn't been any problem with it other than people were a bit upset when they decided to move the basketball hoop and discovered that the playground equipment had been put in properly, that there was this big lump of concrete down there that they had to haul out along with everything else. And I remember because little Sean worked that whole day, and he sat down on the slide and promptly fell asleep about the end of all of this. And they were quite surprised when they found out they got paid too. But that was the first thing I did with the school. And the second thing that I did with the school was what they called the Village Teacher Training Program, which was set up. And the idea behind this was that people would come in from the villages to Fort Yukon, and they would be trained how to teach little things like diesel engine and gasoline engine repair, boat engine repair, some computer stuff, things like that. And I went over and I took everything that they had and came back at night for more. And there was only one little problem with this. When the Department of Education looked this over, they said, no way you're going to get a Class D certification for that. So as far as I know, I may be the only one in the Village Teacher Training Program who was ever hired to use those skills, and it was because I currently had my Class A certification anyway. I had gotten the Class A certification, but it didn't come in time. And this was when they hired Dan Flagg, if you remember.
At the school.
At the school. He was the teacher over at the high school before Rod Weston.
And that was, do you remember what year?
I'm thinking it was 1984. Okay, I'll get my little handout and write down. Yeah, I've got it down here. In the school year 84 and 85, Dan Flagg was the high school teacher. 85 through 86, Rod Weston was the high school teacher. And I taught 86 through 87. And 87 through 88, was Erla as high school with
she was there 3 years.
This was her high school year.
Okay.
And then she became, I believe, principal teacher for the following 2 years. Now, as far as I know, that would be 83/84. That would have been and I don't know how you spell it, DeRue, I think, was teaching the high school.
D, maybe, apostrophe, R-U-E?
I'm not sure on that, and I looked at it last night when I was looking at the yearbook with his picture in it.
Right, we can ask you to look again.
But that's 83, 84. Do you remember which year you taught?
I was there 81, 82.
Okay, so you were 81, 82. Is a possibility, would there be a possibility that John Ruzniak was alone in 82, 83?
It's possible. Mm-hmm. But the point here is that the numbers of students increased and decreased, and that you, over a period of time, worked at the school as putting in the playground equipment in 83, and I was teacher's aide?
No, actually, I was a substitute, and I substituted for Evelyn Rolchauvin and for Dan Plagg, I think, in 84, 85. I'm trying to remember if I substituted for Rod Weston at all, and I don't remember it. So I've been working as a sub. And then Jim Witt had been hired as maintenance person and been sent over to Fort Yukon and received all sorts of training and everything. And he wanted to have his kids do the maintenance while he continued working his mining job. And Ruzniak would not go for that. You can't have kids, you know, working with chemicals and stuff like that and doing that. That's not a good safety thing. So Witt quit, and I got the job as maintenance person. I had it for about 2 or 3 weeks, and the position of high school teacher came open. And I was hired to be the high school teacher. In fact, I might have had the job as maintenance for more than 2 or 3 weeks, because I'm thinking about it now. I didn't start as high school teacher until December, so I was probably maintenance person for part of October and most of November. So I took the job as high school teacher, and Warren Hodge got the job, the maintenance job. Previously, his wife had that job prior to Jim Witt. So then I was associated with the school as the high school teacher in 86-87, and I went to Arctic Village for 87-88. I worked with Erla for, and I'm trying to remember if I worked for her a year and a half or not. I thought it was 1990-91 and 91 into 92 when they closed the school. They closed the school in the at the end of the spring term in 92. So I think I worked with Erla for a year and a half as teacher's aide. And then I was teacher's aide when they reopened the school under Maureen Kelly. That was an experience that I did not continue. And then I went to work with Connie. Remember her last name? I just saw her.
Wilhelm.
Wilhelm. Okay, because it's now Gardner, I believe.
Gardner.
I worked with her for a year, starting actually in December of 1995, and I retired from the school in May of 2005. So I was one of the teacher's aides, or teacher's aide and custodian, for almost 10 years. And I should mention that my last year working with Erla, I worked, they cut me back 1 hour on as a teacher's aide and made me cook.
So you've been teacher, aide, cook, maintenance man. You didn't do the bus driver at all?
I know, but I did custodian.
Custodian.
Custodial work, yeah, I did that. I have been all those things. As a matter of fact, the year that I was the cook was really a fun year because they shipped out, I think it was 12 cases of bread. We didn't have any place to cold storage for the bread. I can remember scraping little green pieces of mold off the French bread to make the garlic bread. Warren Hodge had to end up building a box outside to put a lot of the supplies because we had no place to store them. They had just a normal, it's I think the little freezer that's over there now. It's just a, you know, front loading regular size freezer. That's all they had. So they sent us all that wonderful stuff. We got nice things like lots of ground turkey from the USDA and lots of cheese that almost had a taste. And you'd be surprised how much ground turkey you can sneak into the spaghetti sauce before they notice it.
Can you also answer when they moved the buildings from the BLM, when the BLM closed, over to the school?
Well, I know it was under Leak, okay? And I would say 98 or 99.
Okay.
Lee was there, started in the fall of 96, and I think it was his second year or his last year that those got moved over. I know he was instrumental in having them moved over.
Okay, the other thing I was going to ask you about was, I know you were also instrumental in the Lions Club.
Well, I was minding my own business, and George Schiller came over and told me that they were starting a Lions Club and that I was going to be the secretary.
The secretary?
Yes.
Starting in 1985.
And you didn't argue with Constable Hiller, so I ended up being the secretary. And I was the secretary until I went to Arctic Village in... fall of 87, and I was there until spring of 88, and I avoided the Lions successfully and then made the mistake of showing up at a meeting, I believe it was in either 1990 or 91, probably was 90, and lo and behold, got my job back as secretary and treasurer. And that was a big surprise, not as big a surprise as when I missed the meeting, an annual meeting at the Historical Society 1 year, and found out that I was now president of the society, which I've been ever since. But that I deserved. I missed the meeting. The Lions Club, I believe we started out there, and if I remember correctly, Jack Jackson was the original president. And I think Jim Wild was vice president. I'm not sure on that. Don Ritchie, known as Duxie, was the treasurer, and I was the secretary. The second secretary was Rick Simmons, and then he was followed by Mort Cass.
Elder Richard Simmons or younger Richard Simmons?
Younger. Yeah. And so I was secretary, I think, for 2 or 3 years. Rick Simmons was secretary for a year or so, might have been two, and then Mort Cass was secretary, and then I was secretary from probably 1990 until the Lions fell apart in 2005.
Okay, at its height, you'd say there's probably 28 members or 27 members, maybe?
There were some times that we had almost 30.
Okay.
Okay, I think when we first started, everybody was all gung-ho, and it went downward from there. I think the ultimate point for me was one summer, I sent out the notices for a meeting, and I was out at Half Dollar Creek at our mining claims, and I drove the four-wheeler in 17 miles for the meeting, which was at Central Motor End. And the only one who showed up for the meeting was Jim Carson, and he had forgotten there was a meeting, so he left just as soon as he could get out of there. And that was the last time I sent notices out for a meeting, other than when the president asked me to send notices out for a meeting. So from that point on, our meetings were gone with the wind.
Gone with the wind. Did you ever have another meeting?
Yeah, we had other meetings, you know, occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
The enthusiasm had died. They had a lot of projects to begin with. They put the little box up on the hill, the shelter, which we are supposed to take down every year. It went up there in 87 or 88, it's still up there. We haven't taken it down yet. We bought a building from Reagan for a clubhouse. We even got some land, had it surveyed. That didn't go anywhere. 1 year we had a crafts fair at the museum. This was when Colette was president. Well, it was kind of nice. Colette and I sat there and talked to each other all afternoon, and nobody showed up. So it was,
But there were some good activities during the height of its, as far as fundraising kind of activities.
We had some fundraising activities. We had, I think, 2 or 3 Monte Carlos in the early 1990s, maybe late 1980s. I know one of the shirts says 1990 on
it. And the Christmas party thing that started.
Oh, we did learn one thing. Don't date the T-shirts.
Oh.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, because they don't all sell?
They don't all sell, no.
And so currently, though, you also, you're done with the school. The school had its closing party today. But currently you work on the CDHS. You're president of the Historical Society. Mm-hmm. And you work on the Central Rescue Team.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other programs you're currently actively involved in?
Not really, other than I'm maintaining 3 websites. I maintain the Historical Society's website, a website for with things of interest to local people. And then another website with my new flower pictures on them.
What do you think draws new residents to Central? And what makes them leave? I mean, you've stayed here all this time.
Well, truthfully, the reason I stayed here, I'm retired on an amount of money that I can live on out in Central, have a great time because I don't have to pay taxes or anything like that, and the house is paid for and the land is paid for. So what keeps me here is a lack of money. Mm-hmm. And if somebody gave me, I'm only getting $50 for this, right? I'm not getting several hundred thousand.
No.
No, well, then I'm going to be here a while. Okay, it's things like that. What draws people out here, it's the end of the road, or it used to be. It's kind of the end of the road. Okay, I don't know. I hate to speculate that half the people out here are hiding out from the law, but I imagine we've had a couple.
Miners in the past.
We have people who like mining. Okay, there are a lot of people like the snow machining and hunting. Those things are attractive. A lot of people like to go over to the hot springs pool and look at the algae.
Do you ever swim there anymore?
You know, this really irritates me. I've gone by the hot springs now 3 times in the last couple of weeks and forgot the swimming suit every time. I had gone, I wouldn't say I'm a frequent user of the pool, maybe once a year. But, Bill and Colette have been taking care of it. They don't have the chlorine or anything to put in it, but they've been keeping it fairly clean. Now with the lack of shower facilities in town, I would imagine it might be a little bit soapy out there, but I haven't been out to see.
So is there any other historical event that you felt is important to Central's history?
Not really. Like I say, the big thing for Central has always been associated with the mining.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You can't get around that. Even today, we've got a few miners. Probably got a few miners that BLM doesn't know anything about, but we have 5 or 6 large operations, would you say? Well, let's say heavy equipment operations.
Right, because there's several hand mining operations.
There's a few hand mining operations still going on. It's not like it used to be.
It's
a lot of material now. The saying is mined out, and until you get something that can recover that gold that couldn't be recovered before, there's maybe not that much potential.
But do you participate in any subsistence kind of activities? Do you call your flower hunting?
I don't call flower hunting subsistence because there's not much of those. You know, I mean, I've been known to pick cranberries.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should mention that when you talk about your maintenance of the wildflower website, that this is a project that you have been involved with, starting with a display here at the museum.
Well, there are, you know, of course you would know something about this because you, I think, originally put the bug in Pat's ear, didn't you?
Probably.
About taking some photographs of the wildflowers in this area. And the three of us photographed a lot of the plants. I think we had maybe a couple hundred photographs. We put those, I did the printing of the Cibochrome prints, and we put them on the display at the museum. And then...
I think it was the museum's first finished display.
It may very well have been. We, in fact, it's still sitting there in the same, pretty much the same form as it was 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, you and I started taking pictures to put on the computer. And if you'll remember, we started out with my Nikon, which underexposed all of the photos for 1999 by about 2 f-stops. And some of the pictures were taken with that early little Mavica camera I had. And then I got a better camera, and then I got a better camera. We took pictures all the way through, I think, 2005. You and I went out in 2006, I think, that one trip along the Seas Highway. I started in 2006 with my new small camera and was taking, in fact, I had such a good time taking pictures with my new small camera that I walked off and left my good camera on the mountaintop. But we basically took pictures until about 2006 that went pretty much for the museum website. And then I started taking pictures in more details. I mean, pictures of dried up plants, pictures of sprouting plants. And basically, for example, I think I have almost 40 pictures of fireweed. I've got fireweed with green pollen on the stamen, or on the anthers, all sorts of things.
Very detailed photographs.
Very detailed photographs. If you look at the capitate louse wort, I have some that are so colorful, and some of them are colored when they first start out and really go to color later on, and then some of them have very little color to them. So I've been taking a lot more pictures of that and going out to more remote sites and searching here and there. Everything.
I'd like to just say that I remember one picture you took very well of one time when we were out looking for plants, and there were about quarter-sized pieces of ash floating through the air. We were doing pictures of pond plants that day, and we were on the Circle Road, and it was 2004, and Al took a absolutely gorgeous photograph that is scary as all Dickens, because it looks like it's sunset at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a summer's day. And within 15 minutes of taking the photograph, the fire burned across the road there and continued to burn up almost 7 million acres.
That actually, if you remember that day, we went out to the pond near Jim's Crab's place out at 133 Mile. And as a matter of fact, we took some pictures of a couple of the little galliums. Mm-hmm. And that's the bed straws. And then we went all the way out to Circle City, or not quite out to Circle City, and took a picture of the Colomia, the narrowleaf Colomia. Mm-hmm. And then we were coming back, and we saw this absolutely gorgeous slime pit alongside the road, and it was full of aquatic plants that we hadn't seen before. And we were there photographing these, and like you say, these big chunks of pine needles that had been burnt were coming down on top of us. And we photographed, we must have been there for an hour with this stuff coming down. And then we decided to leave, and we crossed over, we were at about 150 mile, I think. We crossed over the Birch Creek Bridge. I got off and took that picture, and it is just literally orange. And that was, like you say, that was the night that the fire hit the road.
Mm-hmm. Burned across the highway.
We didn't see any flames. Just all this stuff falling out of the sky.
And an orange glow.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you just to back up a little bit and remember some of the places that were in Central over the years. You've talked about places like Ella's Bakery. Do you remember a lumber store?
I remember a lumber store because it was at the place that George Hiller bought from Pat Oakes's sister, Audrey, or sister-in-law, Audrey. And this lumber store was run by Mimi Monkus. And she sold nails, stuff like that. Bob Monkus had done a lot of the construction work on Pat Oakes's house. Mm-hmm. And so there was that lumber store. By the way, if you head off on the road to the Hot Springs and you go by Jim Wild's place, he bought a place, or he got a place that belonged to the Severances. It's a little cabin with a porch, frame building, and then a log building behind that. That was the donut shop in the 1950s that belonged to Les and Helen Stevens. And they actually had a donut shop. I think it might have predated the Buy and Frank's. At least if it wasn't, it was contemporary with it. They bought the property, the building they bought from Ed Quinlan. You'll see his name, I think, in the history of the Fairbanks area. And I think he might even be planted out in one of our cemeteries. If I remember correctly, there's something I think to mention on the history of Central. There was Central House. There wasn't really a community here until the 30s. And Heine Carstings had built a place, which Dick Simmons owns that now. His mother or something had married Heine. The other place was George Thomas's place. George, I believe, was the first one to have land surveyed here. And he didn't follow through on the survey. So Julie Kennedy got the original patent on that ground. The first place to go to patent in town was the place that Jim Crabb bought across from Crabb's Corner, where he built his home. And that was, I believe, Joe Ensley, I believe, patented that. That was the first one to go to patent. The first one, like I say, to be surveyed was surveyed by George Thomas. Riley Erickson did a 160-acre homestead, which covers the area that Red and Jane Williams had bought, although they also bought the Doane place that had been patented by Doane's. First place that I can see of in the area that was patented was about 19, I think it went to patent in 23, and that was the Hot Springs. I couldn't find any listing of a patenting of Miller House. I searched for that one day. It's buried under a whole bunch of other things, I think. Basically, until about 1946, you could tell who was filing patents. From 1946 on, they said it was by special assignment or something like that, so you didn't really know. And in the early 50s, everything in the central core, going out on the Hot Springs Road almost to the power plant and going out to the Galvins and everything, all of this was surveyed by the government for home siting. And those people who lived in the area apparently had a preference for home siting. Hanny Carstens didn't get his until way late because he wasn't about the home site.
So who got home sites?
Well, the Stevenses got home sites, the Domes got home sites. It's all in the records. Actually, you can pick it up all on the internet. And I've got a book somewhere, if I can find it, that shows all of these things. But a variety of Doc Zurich's widow has one of them. And I think that is, I think that might be the power plant.
How about Julie Kennedy's? That turned into
well, Julie.
Which house is that?
That's the one with the little wagon wheels and everything in front of it. It's roughly. She had 5 acres. Okay, on one side it was sold off to Mike Ross's mother, who got it for him. And that was what was sold to Lee and Lavelle Montgomery and has now changed hands again. On the other side of that, that went to Bob Hutchinson, who was married, I think, at one time to Madonna.
Who ran Far North.
Who ran the Far North Market. So a chunk came off of each side, leaving Julie in the middle. That was sold to Mary Lou Teal after Julie's death. And Mary Lou eventually sold that to Larry Nelson. Okay, and they built their big house on that and then moved out of the country. So that was the Kennedy home site. And Julie got that. And not Tom. That was Julie's. Tom was a lot different in the last few years than he was in the first few years because he gave up drinking, is from what I've been told. And he had trap lines. You can see back in the museum there, he had built 2 canoes that he used to go down the rivers and everything. He had a sawmill. At his place, he had a variety of things going on. Like a lot of people who were heavy drinkers, he was also a very heavy worker. And once he had given up the drinking, he and Julie got together. And unfortunately, I never met him. I don't know, but we got up here in the late 60s, but we didn't know many people in town, and I do believe he died in the early 70s.
How did he die?
I have no idea.
Would you say that men and women had different roles in the early days when you were here? Did lots of women partake in the mining?
Well, I have pictures of Martha Thomas standing there with the giant, working the giant when John was mining. And they had different roles. The women often ran the giants, pushed the hydraulic units, pushing the stuff into the sluice box. Of course, the traditional thing of cooking for the camp. The school was a lot better off without their male cook.
Without your...
Definitely. I'm trying to think if any of the women around here... And I know maybe Tremura had a still, and I don't know if she did any mining or not. Do you remember if she mined?
I don't recall reading about her mining at all.
I don't either. And I am just trying to think on that, because of course there was Graziella Miller, who, along with Frank, ran Miller House. Miller House was, by the way, run by Jay Kelly and his wife. They had a daughter, Madeline. She married somebody named Wilkinson, and their son was Fred Wilkinson. And Fred was born in 1936, I think he told me. He was born the year that the Kellys sold Miller House to the Millers. Okay, this is the problem with Miller House. Miller House is not too far from Miller Creek, which was named by Oliver Miller after himself. Oliver Miller's occupation was to go into various mining camps, name a creek after himself, and leave. Okay, so this was Oliver Miller. Fritz Miller came through. Fritz was up here in 1895. He was a partner with Caspar Ellingen. And Fritz built a house over on Mammoth Creek, which became Miller's House, because, of course, you know, there's Terrell's house and Cook's house and all these various things. And Fritz left the country, and Jay Kelly, at least according to Fred, came in the early 1900s, and there's this house sitting here on ground that was not claimed, so I think he filed a mining claim on it, moved in, opened up a little business, and Fritz Miller came back, and supposedly they called a miners' meeting on this. Now, if they called a miners' meeting on this, this would have to be about 1901, because the judicial authority came in that fall. And by judicial authority, I mean somebody that was appointed by Judge Wickersham rather than Judge Crane, who came in 1897 and didn't have much luck being an authority because nobody trusted him, possibly because he couldn't be trusted. But anyway, according to what Fred told me, they had a miners' meeting on this and they awarded the house to Kelly, with the provision that he pay Frank Miller, or Fritz Miller, $1,000 for it. Well, this was done, and up until 1936, Jay Kelly kept the water records for the government, you know, flow and everything like that, probably the temperature records and things, other things. He worked for the Berry Dredging Company, and he sent out the shipped out the gold for him, weighed the gold for him. I don't know if he took care of melting it down or not. Because the interesting thing, I last week was going through the records that we have in the museum and going through Frank Miller's records. He had Jay Kelly's records from around 1920. So that one of the things it indicated is that when the dredge started up, it started up a Mastodon Creek, and it went up Mastodon to the end of the Berry Company ground, and it reached there in 1921, at which point they began to dissemble the dredge and move it down to Mammoth Creek. So he had the records for that year. He had the records for the Berry Company mining on Eagle Creek for 1916. So Jay Kelly was a mover and shaker in this area. The things that were going in this area really were Miller House and Circle Hot Springs. And until about 1920, I think it was 24, 25, something like that, the post office was at Deadwood. And the guy who ran the post office, the postmaster, was named Taggart. He died that year. Frank Leach, I think, became postmaster, and then the Deadwood post office was moved to the Hot Springs. The records in the district were kept in Circle City up until a certain time, and it might have been right around the time that the hotel was built or something around that, the recording office moved over to the hot springs so that the records, the mining records, were kept at the hot springs rather than at Circle City. And as a matter of fact, a man who lived at the hot springs, Harry Greep, was postmaster at the hot springs in the 30s, and he was also a U.S. commissioner. Now, prior to that time, the U.S. commissioner was in Circle City. So the big things in the central area, like I said, were Miller House and Circle Hot Springs, with Central House over here just being sort of a place to get some food. It was notorious for its bedbugs. Okay. And I should mention, there was a guy in the Circle City area named Henry Stead, spelled S-T-A-D-E, but pronounced Stead. And Henry had a wife. And Henry's wife had a boyfriend. And Henry's wife's boyfriend shot Henry's wife to death.
Oh, lovely.
Okay. So anyway, in 1906, according to the map that we just received from Mary Warren, it's the blueprint maps of the Circle City to Miller House Road from 1907, drawn by Edgerton, who was in charge of the project. And he indicates that at least in 1906, the Jump House Roadhouse was run by Henry Stead. Okay, in 1907, Henry Stead has moved up in this world to Central and ran Central House. He ran Central House from probably 1907 up until 1926 or 27 when he sold it to Riley Erickson. Now, apparently you sell the building, you couldn't sell the land because he didn't own the land, but Riley is the one then that's bought her homestead, 160 acres.
And when I'd like to skip back a little bit here to when you were talking about when you first came, and according to the records of the old timers, how awful the mosquitoes were. Are there any other things that you can think of that has changed about the land or the weather?
Mm-hmm. The biggest thing, and it's happened in the last 3 or 4 years, is the leaf miners on the aspens. If you notice, the aspens are no longer green in the middle of the summer. They've gone kind of silver due to the little worm-like things that zigzag through the leaf, chewing their way happily along. That has been a big change.
And we've talked about fire.
We've talked about the fires. Well, the fires, Bob Casey told me that there was a big fire at the began in Chattanooga. And he's not sure on the date if it was 1929 or 1931, but it began over near Chattanooga. It burned all the way through our area and finally was stopped by Birch Creek, where it, runs north-south, coming to the road near Circle. Tremendous fire there, and yet it's all grown up. When I came out, we have pictures of the area where I live. The entire hillside is barren of trees. There are huge trees out there now. Well, I shouldn't say huge, but 6, 7, 8 inches in diameter in the area. They weren't there.
You're talking about your mining area?
Our mining area in 1939 was virtually barren. When we came up in 1969, you could walk along there and you'd see the burned trees. Mm-hmm. But this area was actually pushed off for mining.
This area in Central?
No, the area out...
Where you were. Okay.
Where we are. And you'll see now that there's a little... I've got a road that goes back to the log cabin I built. On one side of the road, there are poplars. On the other side, there are birches, primarily. And this little road, we didn't know there was, hadn't paid any attention to the fact that there was a, had been a road there, but when I went to clear the area so we could move the logs in, I only had to cut down two little trees in the whole area where I put the road. There was scrub stuff, you know, growing up there and everything. But the pictures from 1939 that were sent to the museum by a guy named Vogel, who had worked out there for Harold Meyer on the mining operation that went up the first 5/8 of a mile of Half Dollar Creek, showed definitely that the hillside was barren.
Totally barren. So then when you got there, it was...
It had grown up, but there was a time when we first got there, you could look out and you could see our mining post on the far hillside, and now they're big, you know, there's a lot of vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
The birches, the lifespan of a birch, we've seen about half of it out there. I remember now that there was a small birch tree next to the house. This thing is huge now, about maybe 8 or 9 inches in diameter.
So do you think it was denuded by fire, forest fire, or mining?
No, they pushed off the whatever okay. was on the hillside. It was probably fairly barren to begin with because it's on the cliffside.
Mm-hmm.
But they cleared out to put the buildings in and everything like that. There's a possibility if they had to, they might have cleared it off when that fire came through just to, you know,
save the buildings.
But I don't think so because that would have been as late as 31. Our main cabin out there probably dates to 31, maybe 32, 33, something like that.
But the main difference that you're talking about is the leaf miners in the growth of aspens and birches. Is that correct?
You're also seeing other things in the birches that are beginning to show up. Yeah, pests that are attacking. There's some articles in the paper about the fact that that we may lose our spruce forest due to the spruce bark beetle moving, infestation moving farther north. This has all changed. It definitely is warmer. Okay. I can remember. Well, I don't know if you remember the. I think it was the winter of 88, 89. I believe it was, that the press found out that it was cold up here. Because there was this big thing about how cold it was in Alaska, and there was this big panic because they had to get stuff to the Indian villages, figuring, of course, that the Indians couldn't figure out what to do when it got cold, when actually they've got a history of living up here under absolutely horrible conditions for centuries. But anyway, there was this this big thing. Well, that was a cold winter, all right. But Pat Oakes told me one time that the temperature dropped below 59 below, I think it was the winter of 75. But don't ask me if it was 75, 76, or mm-hmm. 74, 75. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure on that one. But Pat said that the temperature dropped below 59, below zero, according to her thermometer, and didn't get above that for weeks. And we haven't seen anything like that for many years,
mm-hmm.
at least 20. You know, we had some cold weather this winter. Remember, it actually got cold for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nothing like it used to be.
Right, for 1 week or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for 1 week.
How about changes in snowfall or rainfall? Have you seen any change in that?
I can't say anything about that because we had a half an inch of snow here one time last winter, and Becky said that there was 6 inches at her place, and up near Eugene Culp's, they had 8. And this is not the first time that that had happened.
So it varies a lot.
It varies over the area, yeah. And I don't know what to say about that. One thing I have noticed is that some winters back in the early 90s, we would have frost form on the trees, and it'd just stay there. The wind wouldn't blow it off. One time I was walking towards Central, like all of a sudden this wind started up, and it was the first wind I can remember of the winter. This was in February. And I happened to be looking at the crazy mountains, and all of a sudden the white mountains started going dark, and it moved all the way up the side of the mountains as that wind hit and knocked the snow off the trees. Hmm. We've had a lot more wind. I don't know if you've noticed the increase in winds the last few years. Not that we didn't have winds before, because I can remember actually the surprising thing, seeing winds at Circle Hot Springs, and you'd think the temperature would rise because everything would mix, and we'd have one night we had a windstorm and it was still 40 below on the thermometer. Things vary, and they vary on the amount of mixing as well, because in one of the years, and I don't know if it was 2003, 2004, I had decided to go into town on the 23rd of December. This is very unusual because I don't usually drive anywhere after the beginning of November. But I had decided to go into town to get something. I got up. It was 42 below zero, and I had the van plugged in all night. And I started it, or maybe it was the truck, come to think of it. Yeah, it was the truck. And I started the truck, and I went back in, and I came back out about 10 or 15 minutes later, and I immediately ran back upstairs to look at the thermometer. It was 2 above, and the wind was blowing like mad, and it had, you know, mixed the air and destroyed the inversion layer and everything. The temperature went way up. So if you have more wind mixing, you're not going to experience the extreme cold either. Hmm. It was that absolute stillness. They have, talking about Circle City, and I believe the year was 1897, I think. And they said the appearance was from every chimney there was a column of smoke that went up a certain distance, and then it all spread out. And as the winter moved on, that smoke layer got lower and lower and lower as it began closing in on them. That's your inversion and a situation where it could be exceedingly cold. With enough smoke like that, on the other hand, that could reflect the might reflect the heat back, but usually if you don't have any air movement or something like that, it's very cold down near the ground. So, you know, those changes, it's a question of is it just necessarily the less energy or the cold, or is it also the fact that there's more wind to stir up the air. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but on Eagle Summit, where there's a lot of wind, the temperature, when we're 50 below down here, the temperature's up there and you're zero.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's sort of close up here with talking about what you think is going to happen to the future of our community.
I have no idea. Okay, a lot of it is dependent on what happens with the hot springs.
At this, you know, at this moment in time, we should say we're at a sort of a crossroads because the school just closed.
The school is closed. The
hot springs is closed.
The hot springs is closed. We have no gasoline
the
in
store
the town.
Is closed.
The store is closed. There's no gasoline. There's no laundry.
So, are you hopeful?
Oh, it doesn't make any difference to me. I'm stuck here.
Okay.
I can't afford to move into town. So, you know, it isn't that, it was never a big problem with me that when the road was closed. Well, I only lived here 1 year when the road was closed.
Mm-hmm.
But because I parked the van usually at the end of October, I'd have to park it earlier. Because they probably closed the road on October 15th. I believe that's when they used to do it. And they used to open it on April 15th. As far as I know on that. Well, I usually go in and at least have one trip in March. I'd have to give up that if they closed the road. So it's some question about that. Otherwise, the only thing going in town is Nugget Gulch.
Which is?
Crab's Place, right near the hot spring. He's got a campground and he's got a liquor store. I mean, what else does a town need? So we've lost everything there. There's some rumors that somebody might buy the store. Right now, possibly would be as good a time as any. There's no competition.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, there weren't enough people in town to support the store during the winter. And all of our main supporters of the bar are dead.
Or don't drink anymore. So.
And some of those who don't drink anymore are dead. You know, I mean, we lost that crowd, or a lot of them. So when you went over to the store, I went over to the store one day, the only one there was working there. In fact, that was the day before Jim closed the store.
Mm-hmm. Well?
So what are the possibilities? Mining's only affecting the summer.
And so you don't think winter tourism has a big effect?
They got to go somewhere.
Most
and they used to go to the hot springs. And the hot springs would bring them in.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would go snow machining. Of course, when you go snow machining, you work up a thirst. So they'd stop either at the Motor Inn or at Crab's Corner or Whit's End or Mills Junction or the Cease Roadhouse or whichever it was currently being operated under. Otherwise, what do we have? In the wintertime, we have the Yukon Quest,
mm-hmm.
The Angel Creek run. This is the one where everybody grabs a bottle of whiskey and heads for Angel Creek and then rides their snow machine. You used to ride it all the way to the hot springs. The thing is, I think with the Angel Creek run, I think Jim Crabb was kind of instrumental in getting that going. He was also instrumental in getting the quest.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also involved in another thing, and that was the Harrison Portage Loop. They would take the four-wheelers around the loop.
Well, Well, I'd like to thank you for being willing to talk to me today, and if I could think of more questions, pointed questions on certain areas later.
Do you think we used up the hour?
I think we did. I don't know what time it is, but okay, thank you.